Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be shining the spotlight on monastic interreligious dialogue, joining a Comboni father in a Nairobi slum, and bringing you a reflection on what Christians mean when they say that God is our Father. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. This is a story about monastic life gleaned from a Benedictine monk with a strong sense of spiritual curiosity. One that has drawn him to seek other monks with totally different beliefs, primarily Buddhists. Also Hindus. And to a certain extent, Jains. Monks, then, from right across the world who, at a glance, recognise in each other that same option for the monastic life, opening wide to each other the doors of their monasteries or ashrams, unveiling in this way hitherto unknown spiritual realms of learning, offering hospitality to each other in a world where so often religion is used to justify violence. One could describe it as a love affair of sorts.
You recognize so often that the language is very, very different, but there is a deep kind of commonality that joins us. It's an expression of love for the other, of love for the stranger. Interreligious dialogue does come down to hospitality. It's showing hospitality. I always come back to the fact that ultimately it's about human relationships. It's about being in relationship with somebody who's different. But respecting the difference and recognizing the certain commonalities, but respecting that there are certain unresolvable differences that will always be there. And not making that the basis for condemning someone else as being wrong or being evil, but simply recognizing that they're different.
That was the voice of the monk with the spiritual curiosity. The Secretary General for Monastic Interreligious Dialogue for the Benedictine Confederation, who also works with Cistercians and Trappists. He's Father William Skudlarek, and he was kind enough to sit down with me here in our studios and patiently explain how monastic interreligious dialogue began as a way of bringing together Catholic or Christian monks and nuns with religions that also have a monastic order, such as those I've just mentioned. A trend, Father William explained, which in the past 10 years has broadened its approach.
Monastic is basically interpreted now as a spiritual practice or spiritual religious experience. And so what we are interested in is promoting relationships, dialogue, if you will, between spiritual practitioners, both Christian and of other religions. So that means we also engage in dialogue with Muslims, for example, who do not have a monastic order, but certainly have spiritual practice.
I began to wonder at this point how and if the famous rule of Saint Benedict, drawn up at Monte Cassino by the founder of the Benedictines, and once described by Bossuet as an epitome of Christianity, a learned and mysterious abridgment of all the doctrines of the Gospel, all the institutions of the Fathers and all the councils of perfection, played into all this. But I didn't have to ask a Benedictine to bring that into our conversation.
As Benedict says in his rule, the monk, the Christian monk, is one who truly seeks God. And so I think monks have a kind of fascination with the different ways people have conducted the search for God. and the different means they found to help them stay on the path and move in the direction of a deeper spiritual life.
So how easy or how difficult is it, I thought, to tread on someone else's turf? Naively, I thought it was all about bringing your own baggage of solid faith and undoubting knowledge.
Now, I think what I'd have to say is, yes, it certainly is important that you're well-rooted in your own culture when you enter another culture. And then you begin to see how your cultures are different and what one can offer that maybe your own culture is lacking in, and vice versa, what you can offer another. What I found is that people can enter a relationship with another religious tradition without being all that well grounded in their own. It can go both ways, of course, but what it often does is to make the person ask some deep questions about his or her own faith.
Doubt into your spiritual
life.
Yes,
and doubt which leads to a greater deepening of understanding of why, you know, why do I do this? Why do I believe this? So that your faith begins to seek understanding, precisely because you've seen how different it is from somebody else's approach. And then you begin to ask, now why? What do I really believe, and why do I believe it?
And what did you learn?
Oh, good question. I think I learned more than anything else that ultimately faith is a willingness to live with uncertainty and a willingness to recognize that that which we say is ultimate, that which we name God or Abba or Jesus, is ultimately beyond our ability to conceive or speak, and that we are willing to live in that mystery, call it the mystery of love, the mystery of compassion that surrounds us. Recognizing that we have a certain historical and cultural and religious way of expressing that mystery, but recognizing that ultimately it only leads us deeper into the mystery. It doesn't resolve the mystery or take the mystery away.
Being not just spiritually curious but plainly inquisitive, I asked Father William as to how his interest in intermonastic dialogue had sparked off. It seems it all began with a book by a Belgian monk focusing on Christian yoga, but that the actual breakthrough came many years later when he was based in Japan. It was 1994.
I looked upon that as an opportunity to begin a serious study of or entrance into a Buddhist way of being a spiritual person. So I got in touch with a Zendo in Kamakura in Japan and began to be trained and to practice Zazen. Sitting meditation, as it's sometimes called. So that really is my kind of, should I say, formal introduction to this interreligious dimension. I'm not academically trained in the field, and my interest is more in the area of practice.
At this point, I was convinced there must be some charismatic figures in this field of intermonastic dialogue, beyond Thomas Merton, of course.
Thomas Merton, certainly. Thomas Merton was one of those universalists. He was interested in absolutely everything. He went deeply. Bede Griffiths is another English monk who lived in India for many years.
And so it was that Father William introduced me to the world of a Frenchman from the 20th century who was a bit of a trailblazer, spending most of his life in India. His name, Henri Lesault, you may have heard of him.
This year, at least in the area of monastic interreligious dialogue, I've had a lot of meetings, symposia, publications about a French monk named Henri Lesault. This is the 100th anniversary of his birth. Kind of a rereading and a reappreciation of what he did.
He was a Benedictine, of course.
He was a Benedictine of the Abbey of Kergonon, Saint-Anne de Kergonon in Brittany. He was born in 1910, so 100 years ago, entered the monastery in 1929 and went to India in 1948. And died on December 7th, 1973. So he was
in India.
India never returned to France.
So he was dealing with Hinduism.
Exactly. A kind of specific form of Hinduism I'm not all that conversant with, but a, a form that emphasizes non-duality, basically saying that God and the human are not separate. They're not the same, but they're not separate. They're not two. They're not one, but they're not two. It's something that really...
But is it an orthodox way of thinking?
It is. Within a certain school of Hinduism, they refer to it frequently as a Vedantic form of Hinduism, whose sacred texts are the Upanishads.
From a Christian point of view, was it revolutionary at the time? Because interreligious dialogue... Well, it started with Pius XII's Fide Donum in 57, but then really kicked off after Vatican II.
It was really Vatican II.
And he went there in 1948, which is before all this.
Definitely, yeah. So he is a pioneer. He is a pioneer. And was regarded, and by, in some circles is still regarded, as...
Heretic.
I would say they wouldn't call him heretic because he always, he never in any way renounced his Christian roots. But what he was basically trying to understand was, how is it possible for my Christian faith to be true, to be a true expression of God's self-revelation and of God's way of saving us, making us fully that which we were meant to be? How is it possible for that to be true and another way to speak of God, and another way to practice one's relationship with God or to experience salvation to also be true? And again, that is so much at odds with our Western way of thinking. Fundamental principle of Western thinking is the principle of contradiction. Two things cannot be true in the same way at the same time. And yet, Henri Lesseau is saying, I know that my Christian faith is true, but I also know that the Upanishads are true. I know it. You know, I sense it deeply. And that was a painful experience for him. He experienced being torn apart because he said, I simply cannot deny my faith in Jesus Christ. I cannot deny Jesus Christ. But at the same time, I cannot deny what I experienced to be the truth of the Upanishads, the truth of this Advaitic, as it's sometimes called, or non-dual way of understanding the ultimate, which basically does away with all historical, all cultural, all ritual expressions. It's pure consciousness.
He's a controversial character, considered controversial within the Catholic Church.
Yes, and I think the main reason was, as was the case with Jacques Dupuy, because there was a fear that people would not understand, that people would misinterpret because of the ambiguities that might have been present in some of his writings.
This is
Henri Lesseau now.
Yeah, but it doesn't refer to intermonastic and interreligious dialogue, which is above board.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Just to define the two areas of interest. When my chat with Father William was coming to an end, I decided to be a little pushy. So here goes. I asked my final question. What is the importance of this monastic and interreligious dialogue in today's world? In your opinion, of course.
I think the fundamental importance is that religion is ultimately about the search for God. Now, especially at the present time, interreligious dialogue is in many ways dominated by the need for a greater understanding between Islam and Christianity, between Muslims and Christians, because there are too many people who instrumentalize religion and use it for oppressive and even violent kinds of activities. So there is a great need at the present time for coming to a deeper understanding mutually between Christians and Muslims. But that frequently does remain on the level of human rights, human dignity, the need for respect, the need for living in peace and constructing peaceful coexistence with one another, all of which are extremely important and absolutely necessary. Monastic interreligious dialogue is a way of saying ultimately religion is about a spiritual life. It's about the search for God. It's about being filled with God in one's life. And that's the focus that we want to take. Not at all denying the necessity of dialogue on this more social, cultural, theological level even, but saying that ultimately what we are looking for is ways to become more holy, more fully human and more holy as religious people. We Christians, when we speak about monasticism, we seem to think that Christianity invented it. And there were Buddhist monks for a good 1,000 years before there were Christian monks. My sense is that they've had 1,000 more years of living a monastic way of life, and I should think we would have something to learn from that longer experience. And that was the reason, for example, why 4 years ago I organized a meeting between Catholic and Buddhist monks to talk about celibacy. You know, why are we celibate? What is the meaning of our celibacy? What are the practices that support a celibate way of life? And what kinds of therapies do you have, or do we have in our two traditions, for people who have offended against their promise of celibacy? And out of that, I put together some of the insights that we exchanged with one another in a book. But
what came out of it?
Some things about even what we would call dealing with temptations, a whole different way of dealing with the mind, and that sort of thing. One of the things that came out of it, I always thought that Catholics were the casuists that, you know, tried to define the very fine points of when you were offended and when you didn't, not only the sexual area, but in all other areas as well. The Buddhists go way beyond what we would do in being very careful to define exactly what constitutes a transgression and what doesn't, and what the levels of transgression are. The other thing that I found very interesting was that what we would call doing penance for a fault is very public within the Buddhist monastic tradition. I mean, the confession of one's fault is public, and the penance that one receives is public, which surprised me. We tend to deal with things much more on what we call the internal forum, a mutual confidential relationship between a confessor and a penitent, which may have been underlying some of the problems that we have experienced and known over the past couple of decades. Whereas within the Buddhist monastic tradition, both the confession of one's fault and the penance that one does for it are very public. And so all those things kind of surprised me.
Are Buddhist monks celibate too, all of them?
Well, that's a good question. In some traditions, they are. That is the authentic and deep tradition. In Japan at the present time, for example, the celibacy has almost completely disappeared from the monastic life in Japan. But in Korea, it's strong. In Thailand, in Sri Lanka, monks are celibate. But not necessarily for a lifetime, because they don't remain monks for all their life.
What I discovered in this conversation was that treading on other monks' turf can be done. But that, as Father William says, it must be done in the respect of every family and every religious group, who must have the option to set up not walls, but boundaries. Well, my thanks there go to the Secretary General for Monastic Interreligious Dialogue for the Benedictine Confederation, Father William Skudlarek. I'd now like to join a Kamboni father in Kenya who makes it his mission in life to help the dwellers of one Nairobi slum. He's Paulino Mondo.
A slum, I mean an informal settlement. That is the place where there was land. People moved there by themselves, and they put up shanties, and now it is a little city without any order. Then we call it a slum, because that is the...
No light, no drains?
Yes, there is no drainage. Lights are put, but in an illegal manner. Every now and then we are fighting with the company of Kenya Power and Lighting, because they come and dismantle everything, and the night it is put back. Water is carried by containers because there could be sources of water. And water in slums is 10 times costly than a person who has a meter of fishery in his own compound. Now, how did the slums come to be in Nairobi? Nairobi was a market, a trading center, and the East African trade was stopping there. But slowly by slowly, people started the coffee farms in Nairobi. That is 100 years ago. And these owners of coffee farms wanted the people to work for them. But these people were not allowed to stay anywhere near the farmers, who were many of them, they were from the United Kingdom. So people would walk like 10 kilometers, get where to sleep on their own. So slums started mushrooming up. Right now, Nairobi has a population of 4 million people, and 2.7 million live in slums. So you can imagine what type of statistics. Our parish of Holy Trinity Kariobanga alone covers 9 square kilometers, and the statistics of the other census, which was just a month ago, tells us that we are 500,000 people, half a million. In our registers, I know we have baptized 69,000. So when you put that huge number of people in the area in which you are, you can already imagine a mess. But this does not stop us from teaching the Word of God, because I have both the catechetical and developmental pedagogies I use. I tell the Christians, those who are in our parishes, that the slum is not a place you can call home. It is like a bus stage. You come, you wait here. When you get means, you go away. So as I prepare them in the catechesis, and as they go to work, I have put a cooperative. It's called the Huruma Self-Help Group. So they have to do savings. If you are a Catholic in my church, you must open a bank account. And when you save enough, like 4 years, you have to move away and buy a plot and then say bye-bye to the slum. Of course, I will also lose you in the parish, but it is a better life, is better organized. More than that, we are also organizing slum upgrading, because half of the parish is on what we call the crown land. The land belongs to the government, not to the people. But these people have been on this land for the last 30 years. So juridically, they own land out of common sense. We can say they have nowhere else to go. So we have started a system of making sure that we build right houses, the way you have seen maybe in South Africa, the Soweto way, so that these people can become owners and the government can give them papers to acknowledge that they own that place. But apart from being a slum and all the troubles we go through, there are also very beautiful things we experience. The slum is full of children. Those men and women can produce. So my baptisms, the record is, if I am below line every year, I have over 400 baptisms of infants. And people bring them joyfully. We have a huge celebration. We baptize only 4 times a year, so as to give it more impact. When you talk about abortion in my parish, nobody will listen to you, because children are a joy. Children fulfill. Children bring back a smile at the faces of the people. Then we have also schools. We have put up our own informal schools in the parish. For us, everybody must go to school. We have Franciscan Missionary Sisters of Africa. They have over 2,000 small children in the kindergarten. We feed them and we educate them, preparing them for our primary schools. We have 3 informal primary schools. The children inside them, they are over 6,000. Those are of the church. We know why we put these children there. Some are unable to go to any government primary school, and others are a bit sickly, or they are orphans, so we want to give them a bit of warmth of faith. But we have also government primary schools that we built in the parish and handed them over to the Minister of Education. To keep children there, we decided to buy lunch for these children. Our lunch is beans and maize, but for us is very stable. We need that. So we have over 20,000 children kept in school because there is lunch there. So that is a lifeline. We have put up a secondary school of both boys and girls. And last year alone, I sent 90 boys and girls to the university. So for me, this is one way of making sure that the slums become a stepping stone in development. We take care of our health in that place. We have also a women promotion project. If by mistake our girls in the slums get pregnant, we tell them, keep the baby. We are pro-lifers, but we take them to a college to teach them a trade, whether it's catering, knitting, sewing. For us, we don't compare sin with a sinner. A sinner is a friend of God. Sin is the only thing that has to be rejected. So we uplift them. We have other little hobbies we have started, like carpentry, like making hair, because the African woman with her hair, they are as friendly as a man could be friendly, I don't know, with his own family. And then all of the people in our parishes who reach 18 are registered in government. They have a national identity card, meaning they can go to any factory and ask for casual labor. So I would say our parish is a small engine of a family of God.
And thanks there to Comboni Father Paulino Mondo. Finally, I'd like to join Monsignor Peter Fleetwood to end this broadcast on a more reflective note.
I'm a pedantic person. Some people will be glad to hear me admit it, because it must annoy them intensely. But not half as much as I annoy myself. Sometimes I have to laugh at my own pedantic reactions to other things. I just hope other people see the funny side too. A priest in the house where I live says something that grates with me every time he celebrates Mass. He invites everyone to pray the Lord's Prayer, the Our Father, by referring to it as the prayer of all disciples. Well, it isn't. It is not the prayer of the disciples of the Prophet Muhammad, or the disciples of hundreds of gurus in India, or the disciples of Sigmund Freud, or anybody else who has a following of faithful students. It is the prayer of the disciples of Jesus Christ, who called himself the Son of God, and told us to think of God as our Father too. This is the reason he was reckoned to be blaspheming by people who could never imagine God as their Father. It is one of the problems Muslims have with Christianity. It must seem presumptuous to claim such a close relationship with the Creator of the world, and some people would see it as bringing God too far down from heaven to our level. This is not just me being pedantic, though. On the one hand, I'm asking my friend, who will certainly hear about this little reflection, not to be a Christian imperialist, or at least to sound like one, because that's not what he means. On the other hand, isn't it marvellous to be told that God is our Father? What a different sort of closeness to God when we realise what Jesus meant. I recognise there are quite a few people within the Christian Church who find it hard to think of God as their Father. There are far too many people who feel sick when they hear the word Father, because their own father has betrayed their trust and abused them sexually or psychologically. For them, the word Father means fear or disgust and anger. How can they say the Lord's Prayer without at least a shiver or a silent clenching of the fists? Why bother praying to a father figure when all my experience of fatherhood has been so horrible? I can only remain silent in the face of their awful experience, one I have never shared. I have been blessed with a good father, a very good one. Other people are extremely uncomfortable with the maleness of the Christian religion. I have never got to the bottom of this, but I have to accept that some women balk at the notion of a male-dominated church and a male God. Why bother staying in this kind of church? The discussion about a male-dominated church could go on forever, and I probably agree with most of the points Christian women would want to make in favour of a better balance between men and women in the church. But the best traditional theology makes it very clear that the God of Christianity is neither male nor female. Being male is limited, because the male half of humanity misses out on the insights and experience of the female half, and ought to realise that there is so much to learn. Likewise, being female is limited, because the female half of humanity misses out on what the male half sees and feels. God is above those limits, and I think a decent image of God will recognise that God is capable of being the best of both halves of humanity and so much more. Anything we say about God is so limited. All the words we use are imperfect, but we are guided by a historical fact that Jesus used the word Abba, or Daddy, when he taught his disciples to pray. As long as that is not used to justify any advantage to men in the church, I feel very comfortable, but I'm willing to learn. A much more urgent question is what Christians mean when they say that God is our Father. It is clearer than ever that there is a need for greater understanding between people from different religions. We, as Christians, do not have a monopoly on God. Besides, if God is the Father in the sense of being the Creator, God created everything and everyone and is equally a Father to all. When we say our Father, we don't mean the Father of us Christians, but the Father of all of us, all on earth, everyone.
And heartfelt thanks there, as always, to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, currently Parish Priest of St. Joseph Blundell Sands in the Liverpool Archdiocese. And that brings me up to time. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Laudetur Jesus Christus.